Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Isabella Garrido, Jaya Kumar, and Abyaz Karim. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. Kingston Health Sciences Centre is setting new benchmarks in brain tumour care with its Integrative Brain Tumour Program. Kingston Health Sciences Center detailed the program's successful start in a release last week, including dramatic improvements in care, global interest, and the announcement of new funding from the Canadian Cancer Society amounting to $150,000 per year for the next 3 years. Developed under the leadership of Dr. Teresa Persner, a neurosurgeon, researcher, and entrepreneur, this innovative program is achieving best-in-class patient outcomes through a unique blend of academic and entrepreneurial thinking. Dr. Persner shared the program's beginnings and the philosophy behind it in an interview with CFRC. I was wondering if you'd like to just discuss some of the specific differences in the approach of this program compared to how things used to be done that have led to significant improvements in patient outcomes at KHSC.
Yeah, for sure. So I think a big difference with what we did versus traditional academic approaches to problem solving is that we really took more of an entrepreneurial approach. And so the problem that I face, I'm fairly new to Queen's still, so I got here about 3 years ago. And when I came here, I discovered pretty early on that our patients with brain tumors, they were receiving good operations and they were recovering well from the operations, but they were having a tremendously difficult time efficiently navigating the healthcare system afterwards. So I think it's something that most people can relate to in the Canadian healthcare system. It's not always so easy to go from point one to point two. And often things get dropped and lost between you know, important visits and things like that. So I sort of dug into, you know, why is this happening? Is there one specific pain point that's driving all these delays to care? And when I looked into it, there wasn't really one problem. It's just that the entire system was inefficient. And so people with brain tumors, they have to go through quite a few steps, about 16 different steps within the first 2 weeks of their diagnosis. Things like getting CAT scans and MRIs and consultations and surgery and referrals. So they have to get through all of these things, and they were getting small delays at every step. So there wasn't one step that was a huge delay. Every step had small delays. And so cumulatively, it became just a very sluggish system. So when I thought about, you know, how do we solve this? I kind of thought back at, you know, who solves problems, these systemic problems well? And what I'll say is I've spent a lot of time in academia, but also in the entrepreneurial world. And academia is very, very good at identifying and describing problems. So academic approaches are really good at saying, here is the problem, here is a source of inequity, and here are the people suffering from it. Academia is not especially good at then solving that problem. It kind of, the buck ends kind of at finding, discovering, and describing. Whereas in my experience, entrepreneurship or small startups are unbelievably good at identifying specifically what the customer needs, rapidly developing prototypes to meet those needs, and then iterating based on how well their prototypes reflect the needs of the customer. And if a startup can't do that well and meaningfully, it won't survive its first year, right? So it has to survive. It has to be lean, fast, and actually focused on what do people want from me. And so of the two systems, I thought, well, what if we combine them? We'll use the academic approaches to identify the specific problems. But then we can use an entrepreneurial approach to then rapidly solve those problems. And so long story short, the approach we took is an approach called design thinking. It's kind of almost the opposite of the scientific method. So in the scientific method, the scientists come up with a hypothesis, they test it, and then they either reject the hypothesis or they keep it and they publish it. So design thinking is the opposite. We started with no preconceived notions. We went out, we talked to about 43 different people, everything from patients and families to physicians to allied health. And then we also did a deep dive and looked at every pain point of the last 1,500 patients who've had brain tumor surgery. And between those two things, we were able to then design prototypes that reflected those needs, and then launched it like a company, where we launched with all of our new, we have a navigator. She has an email address. We have a website. We have standardized referrals. We have patient education, again, all reflecting the need of that empathize stage. And then went out and tried it. And it, you know, surprisingly, I guess, you know, surprisingly or not, depending on how you look at it, but it's worked really, really well. So for things like time to getting MRI or time to getting radiation, we went from, you know, really pretty low to now almost best in class in a lot of those values. So it's just been very effective.
What are some of the specific changes? I was wondering if you could give us a specific example of a problem that you identified through that consultation process and then how you solved it.
Sure. So I'll give you two very concrete examples. So one thing we noticed is there was a disparity in the outcomes for patients from rural towns, so less than 50,000, versus urban. So if you come from a town of less than 50,000 people, you end up having much lower quality indicator metrics than if you were from a larger town. And interestingly, it's not a matter of being from far away. So someone from a town of 50,000 that's close to Kingston will do worse than someone from, let's say, Peterborough, which is quite a bit further away, but a larger town. And when we looked into, you know, we identified that through the quantitative methods. Then we went and we actually spoke to people from the two different patient demographics and tried to see, you know, what are the differences here? And that, again, gives that very person, that human-centric perspective to quantitative data. And we found a big thing is that people didn't really know once they were discharged from surgery when they should hear from radiation, when they should get the MRI. They didn't really know what was supposed to happen next. And so they weren't able to flag when they were falling between the cracks. And it seemed like people from smaller towns were less likely to advocate for themselves and to come forward and say, hey, why haven't I heard anything, than people from larger towns. And so one way we got around that is we made these patient educational materials, these brochures, walking patients through, okay, here are all the people you're going to meet. This is what you should expect. This is the likely treatment you're going to get, so they can know what's coming. And importantly, in that brochure, we created a timeline where they knew after surgery, this is when you should be hearing from each person. And here are the contact informations if you don't hear from them. So it was a way of empowering the patient to understand what they should, to take away the mystery and honestly, the fear of not knowing what's coming next, and putting the power back in their hands so that they know if they haven't heard, they shouldn't have heard, versus they haven't heard because something has gone wrong, which happens all the time in our system. Another example was that patients would get exceptional care while in hospital. That was a theme that came out in the thematic analysis of all the interviews. They were very happy with the care they received while in hospital. But then once they left hospital, it was as if they were completely on their own and they had no idea what to do. And it's extremely hard to get in contact with your neurosurgeon once you've left the hospital, right? So what we did with the navigator, we created a navigator not only as a unified touch point throughout all the different points of their journey, but we have an email address associated with her as well. And so when someone leaves, if they have a question, something they forgot to ask before leaving, now they can just email the navigator. Well, as before, they really had no effective way of getting answers to those questions other than waiting for the next visit. And what I found surprisingly is that the navigator email is absolutely used, but probably the most impactful part of it is the fact that people have the security of knowing that there is that email address if they need it. And most people don't use it. So those are two examples of just, you know, a combination of quantitative and qualitative insight that resulted in meaningful change for the patient, both in terms of their flow of care, but also the quality of care that they're getting.
Rewinding a bit, what was the timeline there? Did this work start right when you got to Queens 3 years ago, or has this been a shorter process? When did this all start?
It's a great question. It's really new. So it's only been 1 year. So the change happened over 1 year, which is just crazy for healthcare or academia. Nothing happens in 1 year. So 1 year is a long time in a startup's life, right? Mm-hmm. It's make or break. But in academia and healthcare, 1 year is no one expects anything to change in 1 year, really. So we launched it back in January of 2024. And then so a bit of a soft launch. And then our navigator came on board in August of 24. And that's when we sort of really started formalizing things. So really, it's only been a little over a year. And already we're seeing these sort of outcomes. So, you know, I'm glad the experiment worked.
Since its launch, the Integrative Brain Tumor Program has dramatically improved key metrics in brain tumor care. Notably, the number of patients receiving surgery within provincial targets has increased by over 40%. Delays in radiation therapy have been reduced by 40%, and postoperative MRIs are now performed in a more timely manner for 89% of patients. Brain tumor surgery volumes have surged as more patients are receiving care at KHSC, increasing from 46 patients with primary brain tumors in 2023-24 to a projected 105 patients in 2024-25. Despite its success, getting the program off the ground wasn't without its challenges. What have been some of the biggest challenges you faced while implementing the program?
It's so hard to do truly interdisciplinary work. It's really hard. And a lot of my work has been truly combining different fields because I think it's the best way to get to the most efficient and effective solution. So it works because it makes sense. But it only really makes sense to you in the beginning, right? So if you look at the academic structure, it's really meant to recognize and support things that it's familiar with, right? And so if you think of convincing people to come on board, getting grant funding, executing, getting even institutional support, if you're someone who has always done a good amount of science, it's resulted in predictable outcomes, and you're suggesting you want to do something very similar again, people feel comfortable by that. They recognize that because it's just the same thing, right? And so because you've been successful before, then you'll likely be successful again. They also understand your methods because they're well-established methods. They understand what you're trying to do because it's what other people tried to do before. And so getting institutional support, getting funding, getting even REB approval, things like this, there's a pipeline for it. When you do something that is truly unexpected and developing an academic neuro-oncology program as if it was a startup is truly unexpected. There's no pipeline for you. And it's very, very uncomfortable for people because they don't have a way of assessing whether or not you're going to be successful other than trusting your vision. And it's, there's very limited funding for academia. There's very limited funding in the healthcare system to convince people that it's worth taking that funding and instead of giving it to someone who is more of a sure bet, risking it on you is unbelievably hard. So getting buy-in on every level was very hard. And, it took a lot. The reason it only launched in January versus, year one was because it basically took 2 years of unrelenting advocacy to even give it a shot. And now that it's worked, there's a lot more enthusiasm around it. So it's a lot easier going forward. And we're probably going to go to several other institutions, both, in different countries and within the province in 2025, 26. So now that it's worked, you've overcome that barrier, but oh my gosh, the execution inertia and energy required to do something truly different is unbelievable. And it takes a lot of, you have to have a lot of perseverance, but we got there. And I think the moment that the hospital agreed to give us to fund the Navigator, that was really the turning point where after that, I knew we were going to be successful because it all hinged on that. And we have the absolutely most amazing, wonderful, smart human, a Navigator named Dana. And she's just been so transformative to the program. But when I met her and I knew we were going to partner, I knew it was going to be huge. And one more other shout out I want to give to is Dr. Katie Goldie. She's with the School of Nursing. She's a professor in the School of Nursing. The nursing perspective here was absolutely critical. And so in the early days of the design process, she really provided this valuable nursing perspective, but also she's just an unbelievably intelligent person. So gave her overall insight to the program as well. So it was a battle I fought alongside other people. And I'm just very appreciative that they put their faith in me when really I had no data to support the vision.
With the foundation laid, the program is now poised for thoughtful expansion, according to Dr. Persner. What's next? Where do you see this program going in the near future and beyond?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's a question that we can better address now that we have the Canadian Cancer Society funding. That was the second point where I realized that the viability of the project was real. So we're going to expand. I think it's really important to expand thoughtfully and not to blow up too big too quickly. It's another way that startups actually end up kind of shooting themselves in the foot is they get too big too quickly and they can't sustain themselves. So it's important to be very thoughtful. That was the reason why we initially did the program looking at just primary brain tumors, because it's a very manageable population. The next step will first be to expand the diseases. So we're now looking at brain metastasis. Patients in our catchment with brain metastasis have many of the same problems as primary brain tumors, and we haven't addressed that at all at this point. It's only been primary brain tumors. So expanding to other diseases, starting with brain metastasis, and then expanding to different sites. So we're talking very actively with Health Sciences North, so the group in Sudbury, and then we're discussing with a group in Australia. And we're just working out the logistics now of, you know, what does that look like? And it can be anything from just adopting our materials and our pipeline and our live tracker, or it could be as complicated as going through the whole design thinking process themselves and then comparing, you know, the differences and similarities. And of course, I would help really mentor them through that process. But that's our next battle.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Good evening, folks. This is Abiyaz from CFRC News, and you are listening to our segment, Campus Corner. Here we bring you the latest updates from Queen's Campus. Tonight, we are covering Secondhand Shuffle, a Queen's initiative that reduces waste while helping students and the community. As the school year ends, many students have items they'll no longer need, but instead of sending them to the landfill, this event gives them a second life. Students can drop off unwanted items, others can pick up what they need for free, and local charities will collect leftovers. I'll be speaking with Marianne Tierney, off-campus living advisor, and Elizabeth Higgins, a student intern with Queen's Facilities, about how this initiative is making a difference. Stay tuned. Hello, Marianne and Elizabeth. Thanks for joining us in our studio. May you quickly introduce yourself for our audience?
Hi, my name is Marianne, and I'm the off-campus living advisor here at Queen's.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth, and I'm the sustainability intern working with Queen's Facilities.
Amazing. It's lovely to meet you too. So let's dive straight to the event. For students who may not be familiar with the event, can you start by telling our listeners what the Secondhand Shuffle event is all about and why is it such an important initiative at Queen's University?
Of course. So the Secondhand Shuffle is a waste reduction initiative intended to rehouse quality items no longer wanted or needed by our students. Otherwise, they would likely go to landfill. This event targets Queen's students who are encouraged to bring their unwanted items and take other available items. Community members are also welcome to take items during specific event dates. All items are free, which removes financial barriers and provides equal access to all of our participants. This is especially impactful for students who are making the transition from residence to living off campus. Our event provides a designated place to drop off a variety of items, which reduces the likelihood of illegal dumping on and off campus,
right,
in addition of saving it from the landfill. And in addition, local charities here in Kingston will be invited to pick up items on designated days.
What a wonderful initiative. So what kind of items can people donate or pick up, and how do they contribute to both sustainability and community building?
Yeah, so any items in good shape or that are not severely damaged or broken can be donated. And these can fall under categories like clothing, household items, small appliances, small electronics, furniture on Sundays, etc. And this really supports sustainability through circular economy values, such as keeping products in use as long as possible. We're targeting like the reuse of items. And this really builds community because we're keeping these items in Kingston, students living off campus, community members and charities. So it's all distributed within this community.
Wow. So Elizabeth, when we were talking off air, I understood that you have been deeply involved in bringing this event to life, ensuring it runs smoothly and benefits those who participate. Reflecting on your experience, what has been the most rewarding aspect of organizing it? Additionally, based on the past editions, how has this event made a positive impact on students and the broader community?
So this is actually my first year participating in Shuffle and assisting with student affairs, but it's been a really great experience learning how Queens supports these sustainability initiatives and gets students involved. It's a great opportunity for anyone looking to support sustainability, but also themselves when moving out and decluttering and such. And so how this has impacted students. In 2024, there were 2,560 items donated and weighing a total of 9,096 kilograms and valued at approximately $126,000.
Wow.
So we've been able to divert that much weight from landfill and saving students and community members a lot of money.
Great. So far from everything you have shared, it's clear that sustainability is a major priority for this event. You have put a lot of thought into making it both impactful and environmentally responsible. Can you walk us through the specific steps you are taking to ensure it stays eco-friendly and minimizes waste effectively?
Yeah, definitely. So as a student, I've experienced move out and move in from residents, and I know that it can generate a lot of waste. So we're providing a venue for students to drop off items, a designated space to allow for this sustainable action. Remaining items from these days, like Marianne said, can go to community members and charities. And broken or damaged items, we will be helping students figure out where to put these. Any items that aren't taken in from the secondhand shuffle, there will be resources available to direct people as to where to go.
Wonderful. That actually sounds like a really thought out plan. So lastly, how can our listeners get involved? And what would you say to bring more people to the event who are unsure about donating or attending this event this year?
That's a great question. So if you are a student, you're more than welcome to drop off items or pick up items on the designated days. So please follow our website for information. We have expanded the event this year to include more days than in the past. So please follow our website to make sure that, you know, we're accepting a certain item on a certain day or what our times are each day, because they will vary from time to time. And we're also looking for students and community members to volunteer. So if you have some extra time and you're available, we are looking for volunteers. So please, again, follow our website. We will have information up there shortly on how to volunteer. And we have a form that you can fill out to complete. You can also follow us on social media. It's Queens OCLA on Instagram. Or you can just reach out to our office with any questions. Again, follow our website on what's accepted or how to get involved. Volunteers and event coordinators are very happy to help and provide resources to help you manage your items and answer any of your questions. So please don't hesitate to reach out either in advance or pop by the event and ask your questions there.
Perfect. This actually brings us to the very end of our segment. Thank you, you two. Thanks for joining us in studio today. Best of luck with the event.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And we'll see you at the secondhand shuffle.
For sure. I'm moving houses at the end of this month, so I actually have a few things to donate. And that's a wrap, folks. We were conversing with the organizers of Secondhand Shuffle. I'm Abiyaz from CFRC News, and you were listening to our segment, Campus Corner. Stay tuned for more updates. Over to Isabella for sports after.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Monday, April 14th continued the trend of beautiful weather here in the city of Kingston with a daytime high of 11 degrees and a mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to 4 overnight with a 60% chance of showers. And that rain remains consistent into Tuesday, April 15th, daytime high of 8 degrees with a 40% chance of showers throughout the day, dropping below 0 to minus 1 overnight with a 40% chance of flurries. Wednesday, April 16th, a little cooler, 5 degrees with a mix of rain and flurries in the forecast, dropping down to minus 2 overnight. Thursday, April 17th, we're back to the beautiful weather, daytime high of 9 degrees and it will be sunny, dropping down to 1 overnight. Friday, April 18th, still staying steady at 9 degrees but a 60% chance of showers throughout the day, dropping down to 4 overnight. Saturday, April 19th, another double-digit day with a 30% chance of precipitation, but it is going to be warm and quite nice otherwise. Sunday, April 20th, sunny with a daytime high of 9, and Monday, one of the nicest days of the year thus far, it's going to be 13 with a mix of sun and cloud. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Reduced load restrictions are still in effect in Kingston. Heavy trucks and loads are restricted on city roads where posted. These restrictions help reduce damage to roads in the spring. A complete list of roads with restrictions can be found in the traffic bylaw section of the City of Kingston website. Road closures for the week. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, 500 to 472 is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Queen Street, Ontario to King Street East is closed for the dismantling and removal of the tower crane at 18 Queen Street, weather permitting. Berry Street, Queen Street to Colborne is closed for demobilization of equipment at the 283 Queen Street site. And Main Street, Ann to Ellis, is closed to facilitate the installation of a new gas service by Utilities Kingston. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Gardner's Road, Centennial, and Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users and accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Victoria Street and Earl Street to Union Street and Johnson Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
Hello everyone, my name is Henry, CFRC intern from the Department of History. We're going through this week's concerts and events calendars. Starting with concerts, on Monday, the Dave Barton Trio will be playing at the RCHA from 4:30 to 6:30. Also on Monday, the Mourning Doves will be playing at Musiki from 8 to 11. After that, on Tuesday, the Spectrum Voices Choir will be hosting its 2SLGBTQ+ open mic at the Grad Club starting at 6 p.m. As usual, the club at the RCHA will be hosting its Tom's Tuesday Afternoon Happy Hour Jam from 4 to 7. Also on Tuesday, the Toucan is having bands Sunshine Makers and Lavender Town on from 9:30 to 1 a.m. On Wednesday, Whiskey Smoke will be playing a gig at the Buckle starting at 7:30. Hotel Wolf Island will also be running its usual open mic night from 8:30 to 11:30. Also on Wednesday, the Kingston Grand, as part of their Grand On Stage series, will have performers of the Classic Albums Live Concert Series playing the Fleetwood Mac album Rumours. This performance starts at 7:30 p.m., with tickets available on the Grand's website for around between $44 and $55. Frank Ryan is also scheduled to play Wednesday night between 8 and 11 at Musiki. On Thursday, Trailer Swift Band will be playing at the Buckle from 8 to 11 p.m. The Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain is scheduled to perform at the Isabel Bader at 7:30 Thursday evening. Tickets for said performance are available for between $15 and $35 on the Isabel's website. Also on Thursday, three bands, B.A. Johnston, Owl Farm, and The Strange Happenings will be playing at the Mansion. Tickets for the show, starting at 9 p.m., are available for around $10 on Ticketscene or for $15 at the door. The Toucan also has some live performers lined up for Thursday night, with Sarah Jane Riley and Dylan Ireland performing from 9:10 to 1 as part of their Rules for the Collective Good tour. After that, on Friday, band Cheyenne Twink will be playing a concert at the Broom Factory. The show, starting at 7:30, has tickets available on Ticketscene for around $25. Also on Friday, the blues/rock group Hellhound Trail will be playing at the RCHA starting at 8 p.m. On Saturday, Frank Ryan is on to play a set or two at Tiernanog from 7 to 9. The Boo Radley Project will also be returning to the Toucan Saturday night for a show running from 10:30 to 2. Also Saturday night, the Marion Drexler Band will be playing at the RCHA starting at 8. On Sunday, Neil Carter will be performing a collection of classics at Spearhead Brewery from 2 to 5. And later on, Savannah Shea will be playing at Musiki from 4:30 to 6:30. Have a concert you would like to add to our online and on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Again, I'm Henry, CFRC intern for the Department of History. We're continuing with today's concert and events calendars. For events, coming up on Monday, Queen's Musical Theater will continue its run of Heather's the Musical at the Grand Theater, with tonight's show starting at 7:30. Performances are set to continue through the week till the 17th. Both One-Eyed Jacks and The Brass will be hosting their weekly trivia night starting at 7:45 and 8 p.m. respectively. Also on Monday, the Loggers and Joggers Run Group also meets at Fine Balance Brewing Company at 7 p.m. On Tuesday, Euchre Night is happening at Daft Brewing from 7 to 9 p.m. The Kingston Public Market runs at Springer Market Square from 8:30 to 4 p.m. Also on Tuesday, the Lululemon Weekly Fun Run meets at 270 Princess Street starting at 5:30. After that, on Wednesday, folks can head down to Musiki, which is hosting its weekly life drawing event. Don't forget to bring your own art supplies and $5 and participate in uninstructed life drawing. Also on Wednesday, One-Eyed Jacks will be hosting Board Game Night starting at 7, and both Something in the Water and Daft Brewing will be hosting their trivia nights, both starting at 7 p.m. On Thursday, Daft will host Queerioki from 8 to 11. Folks can also head to the Kingston Public Market, which is open from 8:30 to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. The Kingston Spring Night Market will also be running at Memorial Center from 4 to 8 p.m. Also on Thursday, the Out in Front Weekly Run Group will be hosting its usual public run this Thursday, starting downtown at 6:15 p.m. in front of Runner's Choice. All people are invited regardless of ability, sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. On Friday, The Buckle and Daft Brewing will both be hosting their weekly free karaoke nights. Doors open at 9. On Saturday, Queen's PhD students will be giving a free talk in Ellis Hall at 7:30 p.m. The talk is open to the public, free, and will be followed by a tour of the Queen's Observatory. Folks can also head down to participate in Runner's Choice East End Run Group at 7:50 a.m. at the Canets Kingston Supermart, 29 Niagara Park. The Kingston Public Market also runs from 8:30 to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. On Sunday, the Runner's Choice Lawn Run starts downtown outside their store at 8:20 a.m. All ages and paces are welcome. And finally, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 1 p.m. at Memorial Center. Do you have a concert or event you would like to add to our online or on-air concerts and events calendars? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. I have been Henry, CFRC intern for the Queen's Department of History, and this has been my last broadcast of the concert and events calendars updates. Someone else will be taking over soon. I hope everyone listening has a nice summer. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.